Now, one of the things that I wanted to, here in a second, I want to just kind of highlight some of the points in a more succinct manner that I was attempting to make last week. But I also wanted to kind of, in a sense, let you know where I'm taking you. Because it's not random. Eventually, we're going to end up in the Sermon on the Mount back to some discussions that we had, particularly with issues where Jesus began to talk about, you know, love your enemy, do good to those who pray for those who persecute you, turn the other cheek. And what I'm doing is establishing a context in which to have that discussion, and there are many pieces, and I don't know if it's going to take us 4 weeks, 6 weeks to get there, but there's some pieces I want to lay the groundwork for so that we have a broader context. You know, I found it interesting that when you begin to look at Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and Sermon on the Plain, and you get this language of do good to your enemy, love your enemy, that sort of thing, what, you know, we have all sorts of questions. And it reminds me very much of the scribe that was talking with Jesus and said, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus said, the greatest commandment is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, mind. And the second commandment is like it, love your neighbors yourself. Which, by the way, comes out of Leviticus. This doesn't originate with Jesus. But as he said, upon these two commandments, loving God and loving neighbor, hang all the law and the prophets. Everything depends upon these. And it says, and the lawyer, the scribe, wishing to justify himself, said, well, who's my neighbor? You know, and that's the real question, isn't it? It wasn't an issue of, oh, yes, we know we're to love God and we know we're to love our neighbor, but who fits into the category of neighbor? And so Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan where he doesn't actually answer the question. Because at the end, the question is, who was the neighbor? And the man cannot bring himself to say, well, the Samaritan. He says, well, the one who showed mercy. Now, what I find interesting is when you begin to talk about loving your enemy, the same question comes up. Well, who really is our enemy? You say turn the other cheek, but what if your family, you know, somebody breaks into your house and is going to murder your family? What do you do? And it's the same question. Who is my enemy? And where I'm heading is, right now we're talking about I'm centering on discussions of power and authority, and particularly God's power and authority, because that'll have significant implications for how humans begin to exercise their power and authority in all sorts of relationships, and particularly wanting to focus upon relationships in which there is a disparity of power, whether it's parent-child, whether it is, government situations. I mean, one of the biggest questions we're having to, determine now is, well, who fits under the Geneva Convention? What is an enemy combatant? You know, what rights do they have? And I think Jesus' statements in the Sermon on the Mount, one of the pieces I want to show is that Jesus was not talking about some utopian society in the distant future. He was talking about real life in the here and now with all of its religious, political, social, and economic implications. And the Sermon on the Mount, in many Christian quarters for many decades, if not centuries, at least a couple of the ways that people, Christians, have related to it is to say, well, Jesus is talking about the future kingdom when everything comes in its glory, so it really doesn't apply. Or we can spiritualize it. And turn the other cheek is about as political as you can get, and I want to show why that is. In our day and age, it doesn't really turn the other cheek. we're going to have to find other practical ways to live that out. But it is often talked about in terms of either, you know, being completely passive, which it's not. Turn the other cheek is not a passive stance. If somebody hits you, passive is to cower or to run away. Turn the other cheek is anything but passive. But it's also not a violent response as well. That's where we're heading. In other words, these discussions that we're having have a very practical implication at the end in terms of not only how we think, but how we act and how we live. And as I said, it may take us a number of weeks to get there. But you can go ahead and start loving your enemy now. I mean, don't wait. and say, well, we haven't gotten to that part yet in Sunday school.
Just want to kiss one's own hand. You're your own enemy.
Yeah. Well, as Brennan Manning once said, you know, Jesus talks about loving the least of these, and what if it turns out that we ourselves are the least of these? All right, we're going to be picking back up with Philippians 2 and exploring it in detail. And I want to just review a couple of things, and we're just going to go into more detail, but let's go ahead and read it. I'm going to start with 2:1 and go through 11. And by the way, you'll notice at least in the New Revised, and I think most Bibles do this, you notice when you hit verse 6, it turns into poetry or into verses. That's because the assumption is that that part is probably an ancient Christian hymn that Paul is quoting. I mean, there are discussions about this, but it could be that Paul is not writing this, but he's actually quoting what the Philippian church would have been familiar with, something that they might have actually sung in worship. And that's why it is set out in that way. It has a poetic structure to it. It's very possible that Paul composed it. But there are some thoughts that this is a very early Christian hymn, which is significant because it equates Jesus with the unique identity of God. It puts Jesus in the category of God. And it's very early. There, in some quadrants of scholarship, the assumption has been that there's no way that Jews could have ever talked about Jesus as divine because it would have gone against their monotheism. And that this must have been a late development. In fact, probably what happened is that when Jewish Christians begin to spread the gospel into the Greco-Roman world, where you've got all of these gods and goddesses and, you know, gods becoming and appearing as human beings and doing all sorts of things, that's really when you can have the category of beginning to think of Jesus as belonging to the unique identity of God. I think that has been seriously challenged of late. And it's hymns like this that date to very early, because, by the way, Paul's letters are the earliest things that we have in the New Testament. I mean, the Gospels come first because chronologically they're talking about the life of Jesus, but they are some of the later writings. Our earliest writings that we have in the New Testament are Paul's letters.
And we're talking, what, about 20, 25 years after Jesus' time?
So yeah.
One generation, basically.
Yeah. And maybe at some point we can even have the discussion about how did Jews as monotheists include Jesus within the unique identity of God. I mean, what was it about Jewish monotheism that actually even allowed for that? So, anyway.
Yeah.
Yes?
Paul's conversion was when? Time-wise.
Time-wise? Well, you get an Acts. Yeah, I mean, what are we talking, 4 or 5 years after Jesus' death? Maybe sooner?
I would say mid-30s.
You know, within a few years after Jesus' death. But Paul also seems to have not started his ministry for another decade or 12 to 15 years after that. There's a 13-year period where it seems like he's part of a Christian community somewhere. And then he comes and begins to preach the gospel more widely. Now, Philippians 2, starting with verse 1. If then there is any encouragement in Christ, any consolation from love, any sharing in the Spirit, any compassion and sympathy, then make my joy complete by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to your own interests, I'm sorry, that's an older translation. Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, and being born in human likeness. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and given him the name that is above every name, so that the name of Jesus every knee should bend, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Now, one of the things to notice is that how the hymn relates to Paul's argument. He starts in verses 1 through 5 with a lot of language that basically says you, the church, need to be of one mind, one accord. They're implicit, no divisions among you. How do you do that? Well, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others better than yourselves. Who is our model for this? God is. God in Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, though he was equal with God, did not consider that equality with God as something to be exploited, something to be used for his own advantage, which is some of the temptations that you get in the wilderness, right? Use your divinity for your own advantage. Now, I suggested that when we get into this language of he emptied himself and taking the form of a slave, I argued a couple of things. First, that this self-emptying, I don't think we're to understand this as, okay, we've got God, how can the infinite God of the universe who is all-powerful, all-knowing, become a human being? Doesn't imply he needs to give up some of that godness, some of those things that we associate with divinity. That would make logical sense from a human standpoint, that he gives up some of those things in order to become a human being who by nature is not all-knowing or all-powerful. But if that were true, if God, in order to become human, had to give up some of his godness, then we could no longer say that Jesus was fully human and fully divine. We could not say with Colossians 1:15 that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, or with Colossians 1:19 that in Jesus all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. If there is something essential to God's nature, then that could not have been given up in order for Jesus to become human. There's a lot that depends upon that. Our salvation depends upon that. Because according to Christian orthodoxy, it wasn't that God picked one really good human being to die for the sins of the rest of the world. It was that God himself became a human being and died for the sins of the world. And that's a radically different view of God. And this is why the Trinity and the Incarnation are essential to Christianity. Because otherwise, you have a God who needs blood to forgive people, as opposed to humanity who needs God to do what only God can do to save people. It's a radically different view of God. If you give up the Trinity and the Incarnation, then salvation looks completely different. And our image of God is completely different. So, God couldn't have given up anything in order to become a human being. God became a human being and yet remained God. My suggestion then is that when you have in verses 6 and 7 this language of not regarding equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptying himself and taking the form of a slave, my suggestion is that is a picture of what divinity, what the core of God's being truly is. That it's in God's self-emptying that you find who God really is. Is the distinction clear? We could talk about God emptying himself of divinity, and I'm saying that God's not regarding equality with him, you know, and really we're talking about the Son here, the Son not regarding equality with God as something to be held on to, exploited to his own advantage, but giving up, that's a very divine thing to do. Humility is a divine virtue. Okay? And so it's in this self-emptying that we see the core of God's being. And that self-emptying not only goes so far as to becoming a slave, human beings who are under the power of sin and death. I mean, know this. The moment that God decided to become a human being was the moment that God would how would I say this? Let me say it again, a different way. Human beings are under a sentence of death. Sin was introduced into the world, and death was introduced into the world, and therefore all human beings are going to die. So when God became incarnate in the womb of Mary, God was going to die. One way or another, God was going to die. Because by becoming human, and not just any humans, humans under the penalty and the power of death, God himself was committing himself to a death of some sort, whether it was going to be death on a cross or, you know, but that was the commitment. And so you have this this humility of even becoming a human being. But then Philippians says, you know, not only did he humble himself and become obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And we've talked about what crucifixion entailed, not only in its pain, but in its shame and its humility. And that was something that God, as I said, was a unique event in the life of God. But it wasn't alien to God's character. God didn't have to give up anything of his godness to die this shameful death, because God by nature is a self-emptying being. Another word that we could put in here is God by nature is love. The problem, though, is love in our day and age connotes all sorts of things that really don't get at the heart of what we're talking about in terms of divine love. I mean, flip to 1 Corinthians 13. I mean, we've heard this a lot.
Two weddings out of three.
Yeah. And it's a good place for it. It's just that weddings tend to be, again, connote romantic, sentimental sort of things. And, you know, Paul starts, you know, if I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels but do not have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. Paul's talking to a very charismatic church where the Spirit is operative in a significant way, in very kind of pyrotechnic sorts of ways. Okay? And the Corinthians associate their spirituality with their ability to perform these phenomenal things. And it's not that the Spirit isn't doing these things, but a human way of looking at it is this is you know, when you see something really miraculous, you think, well, that's really where God is at work. And if we think that way, then we miss some of the more hidden ways in which God works, such as through crucifixions and other things like that. Three, if I give away all my possessions and if I hand over my body so that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. Now, we can read this and say love is patient, love is kind, but put God here. God is patient. God is kind. God is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. God does not insist on his own way. God is not irritable or resentful. God does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. God bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. God never ends, you know. And you begin to get a picture, you know. Do you think of God as humble? You know, or when Jesus said, the meek shall inherit the earth, you know, do you think of God as meek? Philippians 2, I think, gives us a picture of what 1 Corinthians 13 is after. If you want to say, yes, God is all these things, okay, then give me a picture of what that looks like. Well, a picture of what that looks like is the divine creator becoming a human being under subject to sin and death, and even being so humble as to go to the cross. Yes.
Meekness doesn't mean test or milk toast.
No, it doesn't.
And that's where people get all wrapped up about the mutual inheritor.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever known anyone who was really quiet and everything, and then something happened and there was a confrontation, and it's the person that stands up and makes the confrontation and says, no, that's wrong, sit down.
Yes, meekness, again,
is not
passive.
It's not passive at all.
A meek person has significant power, but it's a question of how that power is exercised. And by the way, the meek shall inherit the earth is not talking first and foremost about what happens when we die. Jesus is talking to a people who have been under foreign occupation. And a better translation would be, the meek shall inherit the land. If you want the West Bank back, it will be the meek approach. I mean, Jesus is talking to people who are looking at him and saying, he is doing some amazing things. The Romans are in trouble. And you know that he had revolutionaries among his listeners. I mean, he's going around talking about God's kingdom, God's empire. You can't go around in the Roman Empire and talk about, you know, God is going to become king and set you free without people thinking, okay. All right? So then Jesus, to people like this, begins to say, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are meek, for it is the meek who will inherit this land. Now, we can expand that to talk about things other than land, but first and foremost, we have to see it in its context. And you begin to see, he's not talking about pie-in-the-sky sort of stuff. He's talking about real practical stuff. Israel, if you want to be Israel, in other words, Israel was called to be a nation of priests. Israel was called to be the one who would embody the character of God so that the world would know who God was and would flock to Jerusalem. And as I said before, when Jesus says, you know, take up your cross and follow me, I think implicit is he's saying, put down your sword. Give up your revolutionary zeal. Give up your nationalism. Take up your cross and follow me. Yes, that can apply to other things in our life, but we can't depoliticize it and just completely spiritualize it.
Talk to me about the character of God. God is love. God is infinite. God is always here. See, the God of the Old Testament, Joshua, all the power, and now is God changing? Is God the same?
we're going to get to this because it's a big question, but I want to lay a bit more foundation. But I will say this, and it doesn't answer everything, because at the end of the day, I don't have a full answer for all of that, or at least one that satisfies me completely. But if we think in terms of trajectory, when, for instance, in the Old Testament, it says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You know, somebody pokes out your eye, you poke out their eye. Now, in its context, it was in contrast to an eye for a life. You know, you poke out my eye, I'm taking out your life. Well, you took out, you know, I'm taking out your family. I mean, if you look in the Old Testament, one of the things that you begin right after the fall, notice the violence that you begin to have. Cain killing Abel. And violence becomes a very significant, I mean, it's almost like if you want to pick up out the worst sins, you know, I mean, there are a lot of things that you could describe how bad the world was. But violence keeps coming up in those early chapters of Genesis as the effect of the fall. And so I think when you get to the old, when you get to the giving of the law, God gave the law to Israel was not going to be God's last word. God was choosing a people that he hoped to nurture who eventually would embody his character so that they could be the light to the world, and it was part of God's rescue of all creation. And so at times he accommodates. And you get hints of what God eventually wants, but he's going to take Israel by steps. And so instead of coming to Israel and simply saying, you know, you need to turn the other cheek, what you begin is a trajectory. And the first stage is to contain the chaos. All right? Sin is rampant. Violence is rampant. So God is going to construct the law that reflects God's character, but is not going to just change the world with a snap of the fingers. So you have this law of lex talionis, you know, kind of limiting. You are not allowed to take somebody's life if they've offended you. All right? It's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's a limitation. Now we come to Jesus, and he will say, well, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say, if someone strikes you, turn the other cheek. Now, I don't think he's looking at the Old Testament saying that's all wrong. I mean, he came and said, I'm not coming to do away with the law, but to fulfill it. Now, think of fulfill in a different way than prediction fulfillment. There are some things in the Old Testament that are predictive that get fulfilled. But how do you fulfill the law? Well, you take it to its goal. What was God's vision for the world? How is God rescuing the world? And I think part of what God is doing is God is going to remove the violence from the world. And he begins by putting boundaries that we have to operate within. And then Jesus comes along and in a sense reveals the fullness of where we're to go. No, I think we're talking about the whole of the Old Testament. But see, Jesus could summarize the whole of the Old Testament into love God and love your neighbor as yourself. All of the laws are intending to be practical ways to live those two commandments out. You know, because you could come along and say, we're to love God with everything we are and everything we have and to love our neighbors ourselves. And then the question is, well, then what does that look like?
Well, time and time again in the Old Testament, love God. All these leaders of the Old Testament, they loved God, followed God. He punished them if they didn't follow him. Moses never set foot. But love your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that in any of them. I mean, David, any of them. I mean, all they were just failures in that.
And then the prophets got on to him for that. I mean, most of the prophets basically said, Israel, you are not loving God. You're going after other idols. And you know how we know this? not only because we see you worshiping other idols, but because you're not taking care of the widow and the orphan. You are not loving your neighbor as yourself. You're not loving the stranger who is in your midst. I mean, did you remember the Independence Day readings that we had? Where it said, when you get into that land, you love the stranger that is in your midst, because remember, you were strangers once too. So, and the prophets do as well. And Jesus stands in that prophetic tradition of calling Israel back to her roots. And looking and saying, what is the essence of the law, and what are the individual laws intending to achieve? I'm not coming to do away with the law. I'm coming to fulfill it, to take it to where God is wanting it to be.
I mean, also, it's talking about the character of God. Ted alluded to this last week with Exodus 33. But Exodus 33, Exodus 34, elsewhere, and what's the proclamation? The Lord, merciful. Yes, sin is punished to the 34th generation, but blessings and love are given to the 1,000th generation. The Lord is gracious, the Lord is full of compassion, all of those things, are part of the character of God, is revealed in Exodus. So yeah, you've got Judges and Joshua and Judges that follow that. Those are bloody places. I would agree with Ted. Somewhere in the essence of God, we're getting glimpses of who God really is in God's own proclamation, of God's own nature. I think
it's,
those proclamations are completely congruent with Philippians 2.
But it's messy.
But it is messy.
It's messy along the way. And one of the things, I think I mentioned this to you when I talked about Genesis 1, as you have this creation, but it's not a creation out of nothing. It's a creation out of chaos. You have the chaos there, right? And the first thing God does, you've got the darkness. He says, let there be light, and then he separates the light from the darkness. So he creates a sphere in which life can be found. Then he separates the waters, creates the sky, separating the waters from above the earth from below the earth. So he's putting boundaries around the forces of chaos. And eventually he gathers the seas together so that dry land can appear. Now, when you get to Revelation, what's interesting is at the end of Revelation, it says there will be no more night and there will be no more sea. And I think that this is a paradigm of how God operates. God does not snap God's fingers and fix everything. What God does, both in creation and redemption, is he takes what's there and he begins creating spheres of life by containing the chaos. Ultimately, God's vision for creation is to remove the chaos altogether, to pull the weeds at the end. But right now, God is letting the wheat and the tares, the old King James, the wheat and the tares. I tried to do a sermon once and called it Darnell, and people are like, what's that? I mean, that's what it was. I'd read the commentaries. This is Darnell, Anyway, lost its effectiveness. But I think that the law that God gave to Israel, as Paul will say, it was good. It just couldn't compete with sin. It was there to lead us to the time of Christ. It was to contain the chaos. I mean, without the law, I think Paul might say, we'd have already killed each other. The law has at least preserved us. But it wasn't God's last word. It's a good word from God, but not his last word. Jesus is God's last word. And in that sense, Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. So when I have to put everything in perspective, in one sense, I don't have a grand unified field theory that can explain Joshua and Judges and some of those other things. I will say this. It's not that you have the God of the Old Testament as this really awful thing and the God of the New Testament. There's not a radical disjuncture there. It's more of real life sort of messiness. But I will say that while I don't understand it all, I'm going to put all of my marbles in with Jesus. I'm going to put all my eggs in his basket and say, okay, I'm going to go with your interpretation. I don't know what it means when you say love my enemy. I don't know how the genocide of the Old Testament fits in with that. But I'm committed to saying that the God who created the world, the God who nurtured Israel, is the God of Jesus. I'm going to hold on to that, and I'm going to say, I'm going to go with Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, because you know what? The Sermon on the Mount is quite easy to understand. Difficult to live out. It's quite easy to understand. I don't understand how to fit all the Old Testament, certain pieces into that in a satisfactory way. But as Christians, I think we don't cut off the Old Testament, but we begin and end with Jesus and see where that takes us. But I want to come back to it in a few weeks when we get to those passages and see, you know, in one sense, how is Jesus reading the Old Testament and some of these sorts of things.
I want to bring up, I mentioned before, but the law, we're talking about God was a contract lawyer. And that the Ten Commandments were really supposedly taken from a marriage contract. And that if, and that love that you talk about, if you love me, this is what you'll do. If you love me, this is what you won't do. I'm marrying you. We're marrying each other, you know, and this is our contract.
And notice how where it comes. I mean, God basically said,
the
listen.
Love's still in that real big.
Yes. And it's got two parts. The first three or four commandments are about how to love God, and the rest of them are how to love your neighbor. But notice the very beginning of it. And this is one of the debates about whether we should put the Ten Commandments in public buildings and this sort of thing. I mean, because it's very particular. I brought you out of Egypt. I rescued you. So you owe me everything. Now, I'm not sure we can put that in public places, you know, because people who want to put it in public places, I'm not sure if they've read the narrative context that this evokes. This is not a list of kind of, you know, good things to do. This is a story that's being told. The Ten Commandments are a story. I have rescued you. I have brought you out of Egypt. Therefore, you shall love me above all else. You shall have no other gods before me. Why? Well, at this point in Israel's history, she thought there were other gods. And God doesn't let her in on the secret that there aren't any other gods out there. So God says, I'm a jealous God, and you will have no other gods before me. You know, but basically, it's I rescued you, therefore you owe me everything. And what is part of owing me everything? Don't make any idols. Keep the Sabbath. Don't steal from one another. Don't commit adultery. Don't covet. You know? In everything, you'll see this seed of love God and love neighbor. Now, back to Philippians 2:6. Or 2:5, let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. One of the contrasts that you have here in 6 and 7 is though he was in the form of God, and then the contrast taking the form of a slave. A lot of discussion, and we talked a little bit about what it means in the end of 6, did not regard equality of God as something to be exploited. What's the King James? Thought it not robbery. This word that gets translated as exploited is there's a lot of discussion about it. Because what a lot of scholars now think is going on with this Philippians hymn is an implicit contrast between Jesus as the second Adam and Adam as the first Adam. I'm not sure, if you're not familiar with this language, Paul talks about this in Romans, I think maybe even in Corinthians, where he talks about you have the first Adam who introduced sin and death into the world, but then you have the second Adam who brings life. And this language of form is evocative of the first Genesis stories where human beings were created in the image or the form of God as male and female. So some think that this language is trying to evoke those early chapters of Genesis. Well, what happens in the early chapters of Genesis? Human beings as male and female, as Adam and Eve, are created in the image of God, as the image of God. And God says, you may have all of these things, you know, all the fruit of these trees to eat and all this, but there's one tree you shall not eat from, and that's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, that expression, the knowledge of good and evil, that's a Hebrew, a Semitic idiom. It's not talking about moral knowledge. You know, when we think of good and evil, we think of moral categories. A better translation might be the knowledge of A to Z, everything. So this tree isn't just about moral knowledge. It's about this tree gives you all knowledge. All right? So here's the image. Adam and Eve, created in the image of God, and they reach out and they want more. They want to be like God, knowing everything. That was the temptation, and that is what they succumbed to. And that's what introduced sin and death into the world. Human beings, in a sense, wanting, I mean, because if you know everything, you can control your own destiny. You don't need to depend upon anybody, right? Knowledge is power. Knowledge is control. This is what's going on in the garden. It's not that they wanted to know right from wrong. They wanted to be like God, who knew everything. Now, if this is in the background, then notice the contrast with Jesus. Jesus isn't just in the image of God. He's very God of very God. He's of the same divine substance as the Father. He is God. And yet, unlike the first Adam, who was reaching and grasping to be like God, the second Adam, who was like God in every way, didn't consider his status as God as something to be exploited for his own advantage, but humbled himself and took the form of a slave in becoming a human being and in dying on the cross. So here's the tale of two Adams. One who had been given the gift of being in the image of God and wanted more, but one who by nature was God, but didn't hold on to it, didn't grasp onto that as something to be exploited, but, as the King James says, made himself of no reputation. So through the first Adam's grasping for all knowledge, maybe all power, sin and death were introduced into the world. So how does God rectify the problem? By being one who has all knowledge and all power, but exercises that power through humility and through divine love, and doesn't consider equality, doesn't consider his divine identity as something to be used to his own advantage, but gives that, you know, let's go of that in a way. And that seems to be the contrast that is behind this passage. Thoughts about that?
When you mention the two Adams, that brings to my mind the icon at St. George in the baptistry. I had never considered Christ creating Adam. You know, the image was the same person.
Yes, you have at St. George's Cathedral, the Orthodox Cathedral, you have around the baptismal font three icons, and one of them is the creation of Adam. Well, the figure standing there, God, Jesus, the divine Son, I mean, they look alike. I mean, they're identical to one another. Adam is created in the image of God. See, and here's the, you know, the temptation that was given, you know, the serpent comes to Eve and says, did God tell you you couldn't eat from any tree? No, God said we just couldn't eat from this one. But he said, if we eat of that, on that day we will die. And the serpent says, you won't die, you know. And the temptation, you know, the temptation there was to be like God. And the deception was that they were like God. But their likeness to God was dependent upon their being dependent upon God. And so the moment that they became independent from God is when they lost that likeness.
What about the free will? Giving us free will, mm-hmm. that makes us independent, doesn't it?
No. I don't think it does. I think that's an abstraction. Let me give you an example. If you go into a grocery store and you want to buy some deodorant, is it really helpful to have 20 options? Wouldn't you find more freeing 20 different types of deodorant or 3?
Why not one and without any wrapping?
Exactly. Okay. I mean, in a sense, I mean, we're talking about, you know, human conceptions of power that we apply to God, and that's really what I'm after. I mean, we have an idea of what power is, and we assume that God has that to the nth degree, and what I'm hoping or seeing is that God defines what true power is, both divine power and human power, which is derived from God. I think free will, the same thing. We think of free will as the ability to do anything that we want to do. But is that really freedom? I mean, I have a theology professor when I was at Fuller who liked to ask provocative questions. And one of them was, you know, could Jesus have come down from the cross? Well, we were all very good evangelical orthodox types. And so the typical answer was certainly Jesus had the power to come down from the cross. He could come down from the cross. He just chose not to. And at this point, the argument is, you know, because Jesus is God and God is all powerful, therefore Jesus is all powerful. So that's all very logical. And his response, which is what I've shared with you before, doesn't originate with me, but him, is that, you know, someone who is all powerful could be pure evil. You cannot talk about power without also talking about character. You cannot separate those. You cannot talk about God's power without talking about God's love. Now, we do because we're very sophisticated and we can do abstractions. But that's where we get into some trouble, both in terms of God's power, but even in terms of human free will. Free will is free within boundaries. Otherwise, it's just sheer chaos. God's power is not defined as power. If God were to define power, I don't think he would define it as the ability to do anything.
Say that again.
If God were to define power, I don't think he would define power as the ability to do anything. I mean, I think that's a typical assumption, that God can do anything because God is all-powerful.
And God creates something in terms of both.
Well, and see, and that's a philosophical impossibility, but let me ask you this. Could God... are there any children in here? Okay. Could God, M-O-L-E-S-T, a child... No. And you know what? We would say, could God come down from the cross? You would say, well, yes, he had the power to, but he chose not to. You wouldn't use that same response to the question I just asked. You wouldn't say, oh, yes, God has the power to do that to a child, but he chose not to. Why? Because implicitly you know that power can't really be divorced from character. And so my professor's response to Jesus coming down the cross would say, no, he could not come down. Because he was there to rescue the world, to save us. It was a manifestation of God's love. And if he comes down from the cross, there's no love. Now, the whole exercise was not to discuss obscure things that, you know, we don't really know, you know. But to challenge, what do we mean when we talk about that God is all-powerful? Because we tend to take human concepts of power, multiply them to the nth degree, and say that is what God is. But that's just a sheer abstraction. The question is, if you want to know how the bumblebee flies, is not to study the physics of flight, because as I said, we don't know how the bumblebee flies.
Pretty well.
You just look at the bumblebee and you can see it. So how do we look at God? for a definition, a practical definition of power.
Well, I think he's saying that God for our fallen image.
Yes.
Yeah.
And our fallen
power.
Yes. And you know what I add to that? We want to understand humanity in that way as well. You know, you hear the expression, you know, to forgive is divine, you know, to err is human, to forgive is divine. I told you last time that Jesus not only gives us the full image of who God is, he gives us the full picture of what humanity is. We define humanity based off of our experience. We're fallen. We're broken. That is not humanity. When you look at Jesus, you see a true picture of humanity. And it's in the image of Jesus that we are being formed into. And let me add this piece as well. It's somewhat tangential, but I think it's important. When God became a human being, when God became incarnate, that was not temporary. I had a paper that I did for this theology professor, and I had to respond. It was kind of a case study. You go on Easter, and you hear a sermon, and the preacher says, when Jesus died, and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? At that point, the divine spirit that was in him, his divinity, left him. That's why he says this. But it's okay, because then Jesus is able to really die as a human being and really relate to one of us. Okay, so the assignment is that you go home and you struggle with this and you write this pastor a letter. And, you know, so this is the paper. And I kept thinking for weeks, how do I prove that the Spirit, Jesus' divinity, didn't leave him? Now all of a sudden occurred to me, well, it's not even possible. Because the question assumes that we're putting God, you know, divinity and humanity together into Jesus, or that somehow God is indwelling in the human Jesus, as if these are separable. But when God became a human being and yet remained God, I mean, this is what we're talking about in the incarnation, this was a permanent thing. It's not that when Jesus dies and resurrected, things go back to normal. Because the question is, well, then where's Jesus? You know, it's not that you have this human person, Jesus, that God enters at one point and then can pop out. If Jesus is the Word, the eternal Word of God, the eternal Son of God, becoming a human being, and the human being that this God became was Jesus, and forever, the second person of the Trinity is incarnate as a human being. This gives you a picture of the condescension of God. I mean, not only did God, in becoming a human being, know that God was going to die, but this was a permanent change. Again, not alien to God's character, but a permanent change. Well, think on that for this week. Yes. Oh, yes. We're not going to meet.
Okay.
Thank you for it. We will meet in 2 weeks. Blessings.
When you were talking, I can see the beginning.